Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, enjoy the show. Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and on this episode of Wandering DMs, we are really honored to have special guest Keith Aumann with us, who is author of The Monsters Know What They're Doing, Combat Tactics for Dungeon Masters Using Monsters in 5th Edition. Keith, we are so happy to have you today on the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So, Keith, right before we started, as usual, we had our discussion that we were originally excited about, that we accidentally got into it early. So, my top question I wanted to ask you is, like it's a really interesting project that you have with the Monsters Know What They're Doing, and right off the top, people can go to your blog at themonstersknow.com, and your book is available at local independent bookstores as well as online retailers. And so when I first saw your blog, I was like, what a great idea. What is your background that allowed you to really dig so deeply into monsters and tactics and statistics like this?
It is all over the place. But I would say the two biggest things are having got a master's degree in education and which taught me how to learn. It really gave me a new window into my own learning process and how I went about acquiring information and breaking down problems to solve them. And then after I got my Master of Education degree, I started playing chess again, which I hadn't played since I was a kid. I mean, I learned to play chess when I was 8, and I always played with my friend Carlos, who lived across the street. And for us, it was not a game of strategy. It was ritualized combat. He always played black. I always played white. We always opened the same way. And it was the kind of stupid chess that people who don't know how to play chess play, which is you just keep moving stuff. You play like boxers. And you just try to land a hit that you hope the other player doesn't see coming. It was 100% pure hope chess. You do stuff and you hope your opponent isn't going to figure out what it is you're doing, which is, of course, losing chess if you play against anyone who knows what you're doing. And I attribute that to the fact that I was taught the rules, but if you are taught the rules of chess and nothing more, you have not been taught to play chess. There are basics beyond the basic. Tactics, forks, pins, skewers, attraction and distraction, discovery. All of these things are basic building blocks of knowing how to play chess. And if you haven't been taught these alongside the rules, and you haven't been directed to books that are going to inform you about these things, you are no matter how smart you are, you're never going to play chess at the same level as a beginner who has been taught those things. So,
what a great
education degree. Then I started realizing just how much there was I didn't know, and applying myself to learning those things that I didn't know. You know, knowing what you don't know is such an important thing for anything you're trying to learn. And so that I think is what really built the foundation for being able to think about monster tactics in a systematic way.
I love everything you just said. I just met Keith 30 minutes ago, right? And I love everything that you just said. And if I just to pick on one thing, the fact that when you're introduced to a new game and you're handed the literal mechanical rules, but not the most basic, like how the game's going to run and what the tactics are going to look like. I've never heard anybody explicate that, and it is so important. I think a couple months ago, someone was teaching me one of these, like, you know, vampire assassin type, you know, iterated games, and with a whole lot of extra complicated stuff. And they totally told me the mechanical rules, and I immediately said, got it. But how does the game run? Like, I think I'm fairly, you know, I think I'm a fairly intelligent guy, but I am actually not very good at immediately seeing the implications of these mechanical rules are going to lead to this gameplay. I tend to be a little bit slow about that. And I constantly wish that new games had at least a page of just basic tactics, so that brand new players don't get completely, totally steamrolled. It's a really great point that if you're not handed an introduction to that, you really don't know what the game is like.
And it's really rough on people who have backgrounds as gifted learners or something like that, because they expect, I should say we expect, because I was one.
Right.
We expect to be able to grasp something in its entirety the first or second or third time we look at it. And if we are not able to take what we've just learned and apply it right away, we get frustrated easily. And we start to say, oh, yeah, we get defensive and say, oh, well, forget this. This is stupid. Because we're not, because we learned it, but it's not working. And that is a huge source of frustration to people who believe that intelligence and problem solving and learning and success are things that are innate instead of the products of study and deliberate practice. Josh Waitzkin wrote about that in a book called The Art of Learning. If you don't know who Josh Waitzkin is, he's he was the kid in Searching for Bobby Fischer, and had an interesting life after that, and wrote a book about it. And that's one of the things that he called attention to, the research of Carol Dweck into entity theory, which means that intelligence is a function. Intelligence and the ability to succeed in solving problems are functions of who and what you are, versus learning theory, that it's all a function of what you do, what you apply yourself to, how long you apply yourself to it, and ultimately it's a function of work rather than talent. Talent exists. It can get you a certain distance. It can make the early stages of learning easier for you. But if you come to depend on it as a crutch, you're in the long run, you're going to lack resilience.
A great point. And the little bit, as a college teacher, I'm among the famously non-pedagogy learned. But the little bit of reading I've read by books by Daniel Willingham, you know, he points out that, you know, maybe there's this core, like, how big is your short-term memory? You know, maybe that part is fixed, but the amount of practice and deep knowledge and deep learning is definitely a factor of, like, how much work do you put into a thing, ultimately, that allows you to leverage that short-term memory in more advanced ways.
The more you work with it, the better you retain it.
Yeah, and the more abstract you're able to do it, you're able to work with larger ideas and get more done efficiently with your limited brain processing power, so to speak. Great, great point. I got to say, we seem to have like a running theme.
Millions of players out there who aren't gifted at all, and just, who are people of ordinary intelligence, accustomed to picking things up the hard way, but there are still basics beyond the basics to learn, and some people may realize that and apply themselves to it and achieve great success, and other people may just be bewildered and they might be willing to work at it longer, but people want a certain amount of work to have a certain amount of payoff, and we're all doing this for fun. You know, we're not doing it to assign ourselves extra burdens. We're doing it because it's a good time. And the more frustration we experience, the less of a good time it is. So, and there are all kinds of sources of frustration that can arise. Misinterpretations of the rules, the cognitive load of trying to keep a lot of balls in the air at once, having to compartmentalize your knowledge to separate what your character knows from what you know. There's a lot of heavy lifting to do in this relaxing game that we all enjoy.
Right,
and
I think
none of us would do it if we didn't enjoy that challenge to some extent. But there does become a point where it becomes exhausting. And so one of the things that I try to do with the monsters know what they're doing is do some of the heavy lifting in advance so that dungeon masters can work combat strategizing into their prep and have a certain set of heuristics, rules that they can follow somewhat automatically once combat gets underway, making decisions in advance so that they don't have to make decisions in the heat of the moment.
Yeah,
it's going to result in better decision making.
I think that's incredibly valuable to DMs. Dan and I talk about this a lot because we've run games at conventions where we co-DM a game and I adjudicate rules and he plays the adversary. And one of the things we noticed is how much that frees Dan to really think about the tactics of combat, and conversely, how little time a normal 1DM game, a DM actually gets to think about that stuff, right? Usually you've gone around the table, you've adjudicated all the rules from all the players, and then it comes up to your turn, and you're supposed to move the monsters, and you realize you haven't been thinking about their tactics right, or what they're supposed to be doing, and you don't have time to do that now, so just go, and keep it moving.
So that was an impetus behind my starting the blog, which was that I spent many, many years away from Dungeons & Dragons. I stopped playing shortly after Second Edition came out. I don't even remember whether I actually played Second Edition or whether I had just looked at the books. I may never have even picked up the books for myself. It was around that time that I drifted into Shadowrun, which at that time was in First and Second Edition.
Hmm.
And I played that through the rest of college. I went many years without a group to play role-playing games with at all. When I did find a group again, I had moved back to Chicago at that point where I grew up. And Chicago area. I grew up in Evanston, but then I moved back to Chicago. Played with some old friends of mine, including my oldest friend, Julian, who had been my first DM. And he and the people he was playing with at that time were playing GURPS. So that was what I started playing. I mean, you could play it, you could use it for anything. You could use it for fantasy. That's what we were doing. So I never played 3rd edition, 3.5, 4th edition.
Okay.
I came back to 5th edition when my wife asked me to start a group for her and some of her coworkers. And 5th edition had just come out. I think it had been out at that point for a year, maybe even less.
Interesting.
I picked up the starter set, and it wasn't long after I picked up the starter set that I immediately went out and bought the Player's Handbook and the Dungeon Master's Guide and the Monster Manual, because it was evident to me that the changes that had been made to the game were doing a huge amount to streamline it, polish off some of the old rough edges, and make it systematic in a way that I had never experienced D&D as being. And I really liked that. I began with a point, and now I've completely forgotten.
Maybe it leads into a question.
This is the peril of getting old. I was running Lost Mine of Phandelver and the first encounter in Cragmaw Cave. And I was not satisfied with how the combat had gone. And my main source of dissatisfaction is goblins had these traits And I didn't really feel like I fully understood how those traits were meant to be used effectively. Mm-hmm. And I started I just sat down with the stat block and started going item by item through it and trying to figure out what am I missing here about Goblin. Because when I had played D&D in late high school and college, there was never really any differentiation between goblins and kobolds and orcs and other, you know, meat creatures. They were all just mooks who ran at you swinging their weapons and fought until they were dead. They were cannon fodder. And I just had a sense that there was something wrong with that approach. I wanted to know why and how are goblins different from kobolds? How are goblins and kobolds different from orcs? Why do they bother to give them different names? What is the difference among them? And when I started looking at the stat blocks systematically and thinking about, okay, what comparative advantage does this creature have? What kind of circumstance is favorable for it? What's unfavorable? And the fruit of that analysis was the blog, because once I had done that, I was looking for a writing project at the time. I felt like starting a blog. I had time on my hands, and I thought, you know what? Maybe other people will enjoy this and benefit from it too. And for a long time, I had no idea if what I was doing was reaching anyone at all. Until I started noticing that once in a while I would get a readership spike, and I would look at my blog stats, and almost every time it would come from somebody posted something on Reddit. Mm-hmm. And okay. I would follow back to see what it was, and it would be somebody asking a question about a monster, and then somebody else saying, oh, you should read The Monsters Know What They're Doing. It talks about that. And that was when I began to realize that people were actually using it as a reference source. Yeah. And at that point, I became really, really grateful that I had begun writing the blog by getting three weeks worth of daily material in the can before I ever posted anything. Got me off to a nice start with the blog, and has made up for the several years since when I can, you know, barely bestir myself to write 3 or 4 articles a month.
It's funny. I wasn't aware of your blog before the book came out, and I got my copy of the book from this is an advanced reader copy that I got from Bob Salvatore when he got some to write a blurb. Yeah. So he got it. He read it. The next night we played together, he did something really horrific to us with a mimic, and I went, oh crap. And so he gave me the book, and so then, you know, you mentioned like sort of using it as a reference, and that's exactly how I've started using this book, is that, you know, the night before I'm going to run something, I think, okay, what am I featuring tonight? And I'll flip to the book and say, okay, let me read the section on that. And it's funny that you bring up goblins, because goblins are my most memorable moment of me really having a moment with this book and going, oh, this is perfect. Because I think I was running a goblin encounter for a group of first level players, and I just trashed them. They just, the goblins, because I was reading it, I'm like, oh, they're...
goblins are amazingly nasty. There's a reason they're on cover.
Yeah, yeah. I very, very, very nearly TPK'd the group. And the funny thing was, I had realized that, like, over the years of running goblins, I had kind of internalized what I expect goblins to be like from fiction, right? From Lord of the Rings, or from, or playing Warhammer, or whatever.
Fun fact.
Yeah.
In what they refer to as goblins in The Hobbit are orcs.
Mm.
And you can tell this. He never comes out and says it explicitly, but you can tell it from the fact that the name of the weapon, Orcrist, is translated as Goblin Cleaver.
Goblin Cleaver, yep.
The word for goblin is orc.
Yeah.
So orcs and goblins in Lord of the Rings are the same thing.
I
think there's some like personal letter Tolkien wrote that like also points out what you just said as well. Yeah.
Right. Right. That's I mean, the differentiation I think you get there is right is when you get to the Uruk-hai, right? They're somewhat different from the standard orc.
Saruman's creation.
Yeah. But my point was, from just fiction sources or whatever, I had internalized this notion that I expect goblins to be cowardly. I expect them to use hit and run tactics. I expect that occasionally they'll have a boss who then rabble rouses and shoves them all forward and leads right. from behind. And I just never connected that, like, the stats in 5th edition totally endorse that. And I think it was, you wrote something about how, like, oh, there's a standard action sequence that the goblin should be taking, right? I think it was, what is it? Shoot
attack,
move, hide. Yeah. Like, oh, as soon as I started doing that, I was like, oh, no, my players are in trouble.
because the way the timing works... It is very much in a goblin's interest always to hide at the end of its turn.
Yep.
Yet you can get advantage on its attack if it hides at the beginning of the turn and then attacks. But if it does that, it's visible between rounds and people can go after it. If it hides at the end of its turn, then people have to waste time looking for it.
Yep.
If it succeeded on its attempt to hide. And that's where the goblin wants to be.
Great. Great.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great moment. So Keith, sorry. Go ahead.
So you brushed briefly, you know, Paul and I did play quite a bit of 3rd edition, right? So Paul and I had a campaign where we'd swap back and forth DMing for as much as 10 years practically with 3rd edition. And I think that there's a lot of DNA in common between 3rd and 5th edition. Like, as I come to the 5th edition books, and to me it looks about 90% the same, honestly. So I think I feel fairly comfortable with it. Not everybody agrees with that. But I know, so you said that you very lightly brushed up against 2nd edition. When did you get started? Like, what was the earliest edition that you started with? And I guess my follow-up question is what you do with the monsters know what they're doing even possible in earlier versions of D&D?
I'm not sure that it is, because the systematization of traits and features and the systematization of conditions does not exist in AD&D. And in fact, if you look at the AD&D monster manual and the goblin in that, they're nothing alike. The most salient trait of a goblin in AD&D is that they take slaves.
Yep,
I mean that. That gives you an idea, maybe, of how to, what kind of outcome of combat those goblins want. But it doesn't really give you any guidance beyond that. And stealth and hiding. Those barely existed in AD&D. Things could be invisible, maybe, or what have you, but...
take cover, as they had rules for that, at least, yeah.
Very, very different game.
Yeah.
And, I'm not sure that it... I mean, certainly we could have read all the material more closely and picked up on details that, as callow teenagers, we missed. But the first D&D edition that I ever got my hands on was the Holmes Toolbox beginner set. And I was never able to figure out how to use that to play a game. I was 10. The only person I had helping me out with it was my mom. She didn't know what to do on it. And so we got nowhere. And it wasn't until... And in junior high, some friends of mine were trying to play it, but they didn't really have the right idea. It wasn't until high school that I fell in with a group of people who actually understood what was supposed to be happening. And that was my friend Drew and two other friends of ours. We had been before. And rotated the dungeon master role among us. So Julian was our first dungeon master. When his adventure was done, Matt was the second dungeon master, and we were using the same four characters. Whenever one of us was dungeon master, our character joined the party as an NPC. So there was Julian, there was Matt, there was Bern, and then I brought up the cleanup. And I think we went around almost twice. Julian had his second adventure. I think we started Matt's second adventure. And then we all just stopped coming home for, you know, the summers, and that was that. So AD&D was my first real experience with D&D, and that's what I ran until I stopped playing it.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Yeah, and so I think that we're exactly the same age, Keith, and also I started with Holmes Basic as well. Living in a little rural place in Maine, asked for it for my birthday, didn't have anybody to teach it, and therefore I was DM from day one and taught everybody else that I knew. We had like a month or two back, we had Zach, who goes by the name Xenophis online, who's the top Holmes scholar, and he talks to Chris Holmes, Eric Holmes' son, a lot, and has a long, long running blog called Xenophis Archives. And so many of us still, you know, do have a great deal of affection for Holmes Basic getting us started. Also are happy that there's been a greater elaboration to the game, even if that was just our first introduction to it. So it was nice, you know, compared to what came right before it. It was certainly a great entry point to have this basic set that was well edited, that was certainly clearer than what came before it, and really was a springboard for many of us to kind of fall in love with the game after that. Really interesting trajectory on that, as a matter of fact. So when I go to your blog and I dig into what the, you know, what this blog is about and why these tactics, I personally really like that the very first thing, their very first bullet point is that they're going to run away. And that right there, I think, is right the biggest pivot, right, between, you know, complete newbie DMs that aren't really, you know, that are thinking on a very simplistic level, and just the monsters are going to come in and it's like a video game and you're going to chop them down and then there's going to be a loot drop, right? And so the moment when you say they actually have an existence that they want to survive and that they're going to run away and get to an even more complicated position that's actually worse for the players is just really turns the game from two dimensions to three dimensions.
Some will just straight up, yeah, you know, flee in a straight line toward their nearest perceived place of safety. But yeah.
Right. Right. But I know a lot of people just won't have them, you know, just won't have them run away at all. Right. And so I really appreciate the fact that your first bullet point is that they have an existence. They would like to continue to survive, and they're going to run away at some point.
My friend Julian, and he has just an amazing imagination that I've always envied. He can just come up with things that blow my mind, and I admire this, and I know that while I possess creativity, that is not the kind of creativity that I possess. And so if I'm running an adventure campaign that he's playing in, I've got to find some other way to make the experience worthwhile. And what felt most natural to me was simply taking whatever situation the players were in, whatever environment they were in, and just making it as plausible as possible, as realistic as possible, in as much as anything can be realistic in a game in which dragons fly. So verisimilitude is the feeling that I've always gone for. And I discovered really early on that one of the most interesting variables to control as a dungeon master is how much creatures know. How much do the player characters know? How much do the NPCs know? How much do the adversaries know? that discrepancy in information produces asymmetries that make combat much more interesting, that make the problem solving in general interesting. Because that is how a party of adventurers, of player characters, can actually get the upper hand on a more powerful enemy if somehow they manage to acquire some kind of information that the foe doesn't have. And that epistemology of role-playing is something I have so much fun with. And to do that, you have to begin with the premise that every creature in this entire setting has its own independent existence and is going about its own life, pursuing its own purposes, and knows what it knows from going through that life. And, there's a little, I guess, it's not direct inspiration, but maybe philosophical inspiration from the old Dragon Magazine ecology articles, ecology of the Mind Flayer, ecology of the Purple Worm, that kind of thing. Imagining how these things would come to exist in a world. I don't necessarily delve that deeply into monsters' existence, but I do start with the premise that they have come to exist in a world that, instead of the biology and physics and chemistry of our world, is governed by a system of game rules. And within their existence that's governed by those rules, if it's going to survive, then it has to adapt to live within those rules, and whatever traits and features it possesses, it's going to use to the best effect it can. And so in that, when you come to it from that perspective, having instincts that lead you to charge at a group of armed and armored adventurers who hurl magic spells at you and shoot at you from a distance and whatnot, and just clawing at them until they destroy you, that's a little bit maladaptive. And most creatures are not going to act that way. If they are zealots, they might. If they are undead and operating according to some kind of compulsion, they might. But if they're just trying to hunt you for a meal, they're going to bug out as soon as you start to fight back and do something that hurts them. You know, they didn't sign up for that. They want an easy meal, so they're going to leave you alone and go look for the easy meal instead.
You know, it's funny because you're reminding me, like, this need to, like, understand where the monsters came from. You're actually reminding me of a thing that I heard the actor Forrest Whitaker say. And, you know, he was in the movie Last King of Scotland, where he played the dictator Idi Amin. And he's like, so I'm playing a monster, he says in this interview at one point. I'm playing this monster, but still I have to find out what makes him. I have to understand why his existence and his actions made sense in order to play him. So I can't just be like, this is an inhuman person no one can understand. I have to find out what motivated him and why these actions made sense if I'm going to play a monster, is what Whitaker said. And so it's a different, you know, obviously he's interested in the role-playing aspect, we might say, but from the aspect of those of us on this side of the screen where we're going to play the monsters, we need to spend at least a little time, you know, thinking about that.
Yeah, the monsters know what they're doing. In you know, it's part chess, but it's also part method acting. when I was in college, I double majored in journalism and photography, and in my photography senior seminar, my professor, Sean Wilkinson, still love you, man, my mentor. He gave us a quote by Bertrand Russell, and I can recite this almost but not quite verbatim. I know I'm going to get a little bit off, but when an intelligent person says to us something that seems obviously absurd, the right attitude is neither reverence nor contempt, but a kind of hypothetical sympathy through which we come to understand what it's like to believe what they're saying. We shouldn't try to prove that what they're saying is true, but we should try to understand how it came to seem true to them.
That's great. So now we're going to trade Bertrand Russell anecdotes, because I just have to point out that I'm a professor at CUNY here in New York, and CUNY has and no one talks about it here. I'm the troublemaker, so I'm the only one that brings it up. But I guess, like, as of last month was the 80th anniversary of Bertrand Russell taught here at the CUNY flagship school, City College, for about a year, and then was fired for moral ineptitude, for moral turpitude, as being morally unfit. There you go. Right. So probably the single most illustrious moral philosopher of the 20th century was fired after a year for having written a book promoting, in favor of free love 10 years before that. And so we just had the 80th anniversary of my school firing Bertrand Russell for, you know, being morally unfit for his anti-war views and his ethical stance and things like that. And so that's where I teach.
See how those things could seem true to him.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I will point out that Albert Einstein wrote a letter to the City College trustees in favor of keeping him, which is where Einstein's famous line, great minds have always been, been confronted by, the resistance of lesser minds. There you go. Right. That was very specific. That was specifically written by Einstein in support of Bertrand Russell not being fired, and it did no good, and he was gone.
Yeah, well, when you, like, are writing a letter to people and accusing them of having mediocre minds, that's not generally the best way to get them to do what you want. That's a fail on that persuasion.
Oh, jeez. So, Keith, before I'm sure we could talk about monsters all day, but I want to make sure we bring up your new book, Live to Tell the Tale. Can you tell us a little bit about, what made you choose to to write this book, and when's it come out, and where can we get it?
Okay, I'll start at the end and work to the beginning. So it comes out July 7th, available at independent bookstores, bookshop.org, IndieBound, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, any trade book retailer. Hopefully friendly local game stores will stock it and carry it as well. They can get it through Simon & Schuster Distribution wholesale. It began as an ebook that I was selling through my blog, which about 1,000 people out there will have bought and remember. This is an entirely revised new edition. It's got a lot of extra material over and above what was in the ebook. I totally revamped the sample battles at the end. There's an additional new level 15 battle in addition to the first, fifth, and ninth level battles that were there before. I created that ebook after I started to get email messages from people responding to the blog and thanking me for helping them get TPKs. And I said, oh, wait a minute. That was not what I was going for here. See, all right, so my parents are a little bit too old to be hippies, but they were definitely hippie adjacent, especially my dad. And I grew up with a lot of that kind of new age self-improvement literature in the house and relics of that world, things like the Whole Earth Catalog. And one of the things we had in the house was the New Games book, published by the New Games Foundation. And by the way, I don't want to put this down. This is a great book. It was just motivated by a mindset that has almost died out. The whole goal of the book was to present games that were that could be vigorous, that people would get deeply immersed in, but that did not have were nonviolent and didn't have winners or losers. And one of the games in this book is called New Frisbee. And the object of New Frisbee works like this. You and a partner, one or more partners, throw a Frisbee back and forth. But as you do, you imagine a circle around the person that you're throwing the Frisbee to. Outside that circle, your partner cannot catch any Frisbee you throw to them. Inside the circle, they can catch any Frisbee you throw to them. Your goal is to throw the Frisbee at the edge of the circle so that they catch it, but they have to give it their all in order to catch it.
Interesting.
And one of the interesting things to me about that is that when I studied education in graduate school, there's a an educational psychologist named Lev Vygotsky who came up with the concept of zone of proximal development. In a nutshell, you learn best when you are given challenges that you can solve but have to work as hard as you can to solve. Those are the ones that produce the most growth. And I think that dungeon mastering is a lot like New Frisbee. You want to challenge your players so that they have a chance of winning, but the victory feels satisfying. You don't want monsters that are going to massacre them, at least not without giving them a fair chance to run away. But you also don't want to give them combat that's too easy, because that's not fulfilling. You want to make them feel like they earned their victories. And not just feel like it. I mean, you want them to have actually earned their victories. That is really what I am going for when I write monster analyses on the monsters know what they're doing, because if you are not using a monster to its full potential the way it was designed to be used, you're actually not getting the full challenge rating out of it. Your CR7 monster is maybe only really a CR4, CR5 monster, and so your players are not going to feel like they really earned that victory. There's going to be a little emptiness to the win. So that plus verisimilitude are what I'm really going for with the blog, not to help DMs slaughter their players. Cause I am very, very much of the mentality that as the DM, you have to fundamentally be on your player's side. If you see your role as being adversarial to the PCs, you're going to create a table of tension and conflict and misery. You are a friend to your players, giving them an experience that they can enjoy by putting before them challenges that they have to overcome. And that is my vision of what being a good DM is. So when I started to get these messages saying thank you for the TPK, I thought, okay, well, now I've released all of these, you know, intelligent, effective monsters into the world. Now I've got to give players the tools to fight back. And so Live to Tell the Tale, the ebook, originated as my beginner's course in the basics beyond the basics of how to run player characters in combat. You've got the rules. Okay, now here's how to use the rules so that your player can go out there and your player character can go out there and be effective with what they've got. That ebook, I think, is what got the attention of the editor at Saga Press, who reached out to me and asked if I would turn that and the blog into trade books. So that's what Live to Tell the Tale is all about. It's now the monsters know what they're doing is really broadly aimed at every level of DM. Beginners can get the introduction to how to think about these things in the first place. Advanced DMs, they don't need my book. It's just saving them work. Live to Tell the Tale is more explicitly aimed at the beginner and intermediate player. There are always benefits that an advanced player can obtain from going back to the fundamentals once in a while. But really, Live to Tell the Tale is more aimed at the beginning and intermediate player. There are going to be things in there that to the advanced player are pretty obvious. But, you know, I want everyone to buy it, so I try to make it entertaining. maybe there's some value in that.
Great. I mean, I assume there was some sort of scale balancing going on here in terms of the pair of books.
100%. This is my Live to Tell the Tale is my atonement.
I mean, I love the new Frisbee analogy. I feel like TPKs are such an interesting topic because, in my opinion, I always feel like TPK has to be on the table, right? It has to be a possibility that it could happen. Yeah. It should be rare. Yeah. It should be dramatic. It should be traumatic. But if it's not possible, then you've taken all the teeth out of the experience of succeeding.
But, you know, no one really talks in these terms anymore. But when I was in college, there was this... See, back then, we didn't call memes. they were just things that people forwarded to each other by email and that made their way through by word of mouth.
Well, I think Daniel Dennett made up the name meme in like 1989, right? In his, I think, isn't that in Gödel, Escher, Bach?
Or, no, it wasn't.
No, it's a mind.
It was Dawkins.
There you go. Thank you. Yeah, you're right. You're right. There you go.
Or maybe it wasn't even Dawkins. Dawkins
was totally
wrote himself
Dawkins.
Gene.
Yeah, and then he had an appendix in the second edition on now I'm defining this thing called memes.
Okay, the selfish meme followed the selfish
totally.
Gene. Anyway.
Yeah. You're welcome, Paul.
but there was a thing circulating that classified role-playing gamers into four types: real men, real role-players, loonies, and munchkins.
Yeah, I remember that.
So the munchkins were the young kids who had no sense of proportion and were just total power gamers on a power trip. Real men were the ones who came out of the wargaming background and just, you know, wanted to be tough and beat things. Loonies, of course, the ones who would do anything for a cheap laugh. And then the real role players who were the ones who said who saw the potential in the role playing side of the game and said, "Hey, why risk my character's life in a fight at all if I can bribe a guard or something like that? Fast talk somebody." Mm-hmm. In my youth, I had my pronounced loony streak, but but at a core, I've always been the real role player. And these days, I think you won't hear people say real role player, but you will hear people talk about wanting to have an immersive RP experience. Mm-hmm. I'm down with that 100%. People who are into immersive RP love the characters they create, as well they should. It's an inspired act of creativity to bring a PC like this into the world. And when you do that, you don't want him to die stupidly, do you?
Yeah.
No, you want to keep this character alive so that they can play out their arc and achieve whatever it is that they wanted to achieve in life and be the person that you made them. And I think there are a lot of people who see combat and role-playing as opposite ends of a spectrum. And I suppose they can be if you are that single-minded about either one. But both of them are pillars in this game we call D&D. And combat is one of the ways by which your character achieves their goals. If they can do everything by way of social interaction, great. But combat is the one that actually puts the character's life at risk. And so if you want to keep this character alive, it behooves you to know how to make the best use of them in combat. And, you know, you can also even think about that as a kind of method acting in and of itself. If you are playing a rogue, let's say, a rogue is a very skill-dependent class. You might not spend all your time thinking about how to make the best use of a rogue's skills, but a rogue who's going to survive is spending all of their time thinking about how to make the best use of a rogue's skills, a lot more time than you are. And so understanding that PC's abilities is in part a way to get into that character, to get into their head, and to express what it's like to be that character. It's a part of being them. Wizards who have to spend all their time inscribing spells and looking for new ones and stuff like that. Which, by the way, I think, not to heap too much praise on something that is already widely praised, but Critical Role, the way Liam O'Brien plays Caleb Widowgast as a wizard who is constantly having to bust his hump to gather the knowledge that makes him a more versatile and effective wizard is a beautiful illustration of something that is very easy to overlook. Mm. And that's what it's like to be a wizard, to be living a life of constant research and study and acquisition by fair means or foul of the kind of knowledge that increases your power. This is all part of the characters that you've created, whether they were part of your high concept or not. It's what makes them effective members of their character class. And so understanding these things is a great way to get into character, a great way to keep your character alive so that they can do more of the things that you hoped they would do when you created them. And a way to allow them to achieve more awesome and heroic things. Because every sample combat that I include in the back half of Live to Tell the Tale is either hard or deadly. And spoiler alert, the PCs win them all. Because I'm wanting them to be illustrations of how to make good decisions. So I talk about some of the decisions they could have made. Then I have them make the good ones. There are encounters that are nominally hard or deadly that if you know what you're doing, you can neutralize some of the risks, multiply your strengths and amplify your strengths and take on challenges that the book would predict would kill you.
You know, Keith, those are really great observations. And let me touch back on the one issue. And then I'll ask you what probably is my last question before we run out of time. So you're talking about the DM, being being in favor of the players ultimately. And it's something that has become, more crystallized for me in the last couple of years as I ran things, is that this, on the one hand, I'm playing this wrestling heel situation of I'm out to get you, I'm out to destroy you, right? But it's really this play act, honestly. It's this act of kifabe, I guess they say it in wrestling, right? And I think that, you know, that comes, if you go back to the first,
but I know what you're talking about.
I'm not the wrestling. I'm not the wrestling guy. I'm just wrestling guy adjacent, right? So I read it and I don't know how to pronounce it, like a whole lot of other things. So I think that like if you go back to the first edition books, right? I think that comes through in Gygax's writing. He's writing from this like, oh, destroy him and hit him with bolts from the blue, but that isn't actually how he actually really literally ran it. And so I find for me, like, I am unintentionally like a huge fan of the player characters that the players are bringing to the table. And so for me, if push came to shove, I would probably make a subjective decision in favor of the player characters, because as a viewer, I've become a big fan of them. So what I do is I actually put a whole lot of mechanical stuff in my way to make things more objective, such as rolling the dice in the open so that it's out of my control and the dice are going to tell me whether the player characters survived or not. Now, some people, obviously, you know, some DMs do a whole lot of fudging behind the scenes and they report something different than they actually rolled for the dice. Or if the players start to become, you know, start to lose, they say that the boss doesn't bother to come in this time, or they reduce the number of monsters. Keith, when you are DMing, do you do any fudging at all in order to keep the players alive, or do you avoid that?
I avoid it. I do it on very, very rare occasions. Only when something would be unfairly catastrophic.
Okay.
Most of the time, I don't fudge at all. And the reason for that has a lot to do with, you know, this is a game of odds. Any game with dice is going to be a game of odds. And there is a range of outcomes that can occur at any given time. And that entire range of possibilities has to be possible. And another belief that I have is that bounded creativity produces better, more interesting results than unbounded creativity. Yeah. I think that people, as much as they might like the idea of having no limits, the coolest stuff happens within limits. And risk is a limit. The possibility of a TPK is a limit. The possibility of an encounter just going completely sideways in unpredictable ways is a limit. And these are all, you know, so much of the fun of D&D combat comes to having to adapt on the fly to something no one expected to happen. Those are the best moments, especially when somebody pulls out just a wackadoo idea that actually, given the circumstances, has a reasonable chance of working, and then they roll the dice and get an 18 or a 20 or whatever, and oh my God, it actually worked. Those are the best moments. People love those moments. And I love those moments as the DM. I love to see them. I love when players in the crucible of combat, pressured by the chance of something going horribly wrong, rack their brains and comb their character sheets and find that one lifeline they can grab onto. And do grab onto it and it saves the day. Things that save the day are great storytelling. And, you know, so that's what I love to see. That's what I mean when I say being fundamentally on the player's side. I'm never going to coddle them, but I'm going to give them every chance in the world to save themselves.
I think that's a great place to be. I agree with that. And one of our viewers here, John Miller, just said, just say no to fudging. And I think that's one of the philosophical principles of the Wandering DM show, actually. So I'm glad that we're currently all in agreement with that, because when there's no safety net and the players somehow find some way of nabbing victory away from certain death anyway, that's the best, most memorable, most amazing, you know, part of why we do this live. So,
and I never, ever, ever fudge against the players. Anytime I do fudge, yep. And it's very, very rare, but anytime I do fudge, it's always against myself, because something happened that would have things going so wrong.
Yeah.
That I feel like, oh man, this is not what I signed my players up for. This is much, much worse than the level of danger that I expected them to face. Then sometimes I will fudge.
Great. And I agree with that. I know there are some people that say, oh, if the players are having it too easy, just send in more monsters. There's monsters show up out of nowhere just to pile on and make it harder. And I'm like, I don't think I do that myself. I'm just like, you know what? There will be another encounter later on that's horrible enough. You know, you got this one, guys. Good job, I guess. The next one will be worse. But I agree with that. I don't think I fudge against players. I can't remember ever doing that. So, good point. Really, really solid DMing all around.
I try.
So that's about our time. We're up against the clock here, guys. So I got to rein us in. I'm sure we could sit here and talk for many hours more about DMing and monsters and balance, but we got to wrap it up. So if any of our viewers have any thoughts about when it is or is not appropriate for the DM to adjust the encounter on the fly, leave us some comments here in the video. We'd love to hear from you. Or any other thoughts that our conversation with Keith have provoked, ideas for future topics you'd like to see us cover, please post them here.
And as we wrap up, I'll say that the Monsters Know What They're Doing is my current go-to resource to get up to speed on monsters as I learn how to run 5th edition, stuff like that in a couple of cases. So again, look for Keith's blog, whatthemonstersknow.org. Is that right? .org, right?
It's just themonstersknow.com.
themonstersknow.com. And please look for Keith's book, currently available, The Monsters Know What They're Doing, at your local bookstore, or you could special order it at your local game store, or find it at a bookstore online or other online retailers. And look for it. You can pre-order Live to Tell the Tale right now. Is that right, Keith?
Yes.
Great. So please look for that. And remember that for us, the Wandering DMs, you can like and you can follow and you can subscribe to us on sites such as YouTube and Twitter and Twitch and Facebook, where we are the handle Wandering DMs on all of those sites.
You can also listen to our show in audio-only podcast format if you prefer. You can find that on our website at wanderingdms.com or through the many various podcast purveyors out there, such as iTunes and Google Podcast and Spotify, and etc. If you are listening to this as a podcast on one of those sites, please take a moment to rate and review us. We really appreciate it.
We definitely do. Thank you to so much to all of the patrons who support our show. We could not do what we're doing and have a great guests like Keith Amon on today like we did. So if you'd like to join our patrons, please do visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Remember, we do have 4 live shows a week. We got the solo show Tuesday with me and Paul. We got 10 Dead Rats live play Thursday. We have Wargaming. We'll be back next Sunday night, and then we'll have the talk show Sunday at 1 p.m. like we always do. Thank you again, Keith, so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me. It was great.
Awesome. Join us next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.